From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in for Chris Boyd. Just about every American child graduates having heard the fundamental values of modern America developed from the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. But now comes another interpretation of the America of today. Kermit Roosevelt is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law. He's also the great-great-grandson of former President Theodore Roosevelt. His latest book, The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story, points to Abraham Lincoln's era as our true founding. Kermit Roosevelt joins us. Welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be with you.
So now, you're right that we've really been telling a lie, living a lie, when it comes to preaching the story of the American founding and the values that we have today, particularly about equality. We didn't get them from the founding fathers, really, or the Declaration or the founders' Constitution, right?
Yeah, I think you could call it a lie. I mean, it's a strong word, and I try not to claim historical truth and say that people who disagree are wrong or lying. But I do think that we've been misrepresenting our history in a very fundamental way. And what I'm talking about is not really what our values are, because I think we all agree that America is committed to liberty and we're committed to equality in the sense that the government should treat people equally or respect people equally. And of course, we don't always live up to those values. But the real point that I'm trying to make is that those values come from a different source and at a different time than we've been telling ourselves.
So is it fair to say that we are not so much the heirs of that original vision as we are a vision that came years later?
Yeah, a vision that came years later and a vision that came in part in opposition to the original vision. So the standard story, what we usually tell ourselves, the key point there is America's fundamental values are there at the very beginning in 1776 in the Declaration of Independence, basically in the phrase, all men are created equal, put there by Thomas Jefferson. And that's what the nation is built around from the beginning. It's sort of at the heart of the Revolution. But if you think about the historical context, it's pretty clear Jefferson and the people who read the Declaration in 1776 didn't understand it that way. This is a different reading that gets put in decades later, not by the original founding fathers of America, but actually by abolitionists, by people who are recognizing the injustice in the world that they were born into and trying to change it.
So what was the America then that was envisioned by Jefferson and others that has changed since then?
Well, Jefferson's America, and you can sort of see this if you trace the impact of the Declaration of Independence through American history, is really concerned with sort of national self-determination. So there's a people, and the people gets to decide who they are. They get to decide who belongs to the community and who gets rights and who's an outsider who doesn't have rights. And then the people get to decide on the form of their government. And they get to decide on the relationship between the people and some larger political organization. Maybe it's the British Empire, maybe it's the United States of America. But it's about independence and self-determination in a sort of collective sense. And the Declaration of Independence, this is one of the really striking realizations that I came to, it doesn't really say anything about the form a government should take. It says that the government should protect the natural rights of the people who create it, and it should be formed by consent, but it's actually not pro-democracy. So democracy is an American value that also comes later and comes from somewhere else.
So the Declaration, what I think I'm hearing you say, it does put forward an idea about the origin of legitimate political authority, the reasons why it can be rejected, for example, within a political community, but it doesn't really, I don't really see it saying anything about the people who live outside of that community.
Yes, and that's I think, a really key point, because we think about the Declaration now as this sort of statement of universal rights and the way the government should treat everyone. But of course, that's not what Jefferson is concerned about. That's not what the Patriots in 1776 are concerned about, not what the government should do with respect to outsiders. They're concerned with the relationship within a political community, between the governors and the governed, specifically between the colonists and the British crown. And what they're trying to say is King George's exercise of authority used to be legitimate, but now it's not. And so we're entitled to reject it and declare our independence, because of course it's a declaration of independence, not a declaration of rights. So the whole concern is, where does legitimate political authority come from? When can it be rejected? And of course, if you don't have a relationship of legitimate political authority, if you have a relationship based on force, for instance, like slavery, then the theory of the Declaration just doesn't address that kind of relationship.
Now, you know, the new Constitution, it avoids, there are words it avoids. It avoids slavery, and I believe that it avoids nation. I seem to recall that John Calhoun, who would later become vice president in the 19th century, he used to tell people, look, I don't ever use the word nation when I'm talking about the United States. I'm always using the word union or confederacy, because we're not a nation. We are a confederacy of equal and sovereign states. That's the common idea that people have at the time.
Definitely that's the common idea at the time. So the Declaration of Independence says we are now fully independent states, and we're entitled to do whatever states may do. You know, the states are allowed to make treaties and have their own armies and so on. They're completely independent. Then you get the Articles of Confederation, which brings them into some sort of league of mutual defense. And then you get the Constitution, which is a stronger union, but still not a nation in the way that we think of the United States today. And maybe the easiest way to see this is we use United States as a singular now. We say the United States is. But if you read the Constitution that was written in 1787, United States is plural every time it's used. So they say, you know, when they're talking about the United States, they say their authority.
You know, there are two things that you point out. The Betsy Ross flag shows us 13 stars in a circle, but each of those stars represents a state where slavery was legal. Slavery isn't, it's not in this Declaration of Independence, but slave rebellions are. So is that kind of the outside community also that we might be talking about?
Right. So I said the Declaration of Independence is mostly concerned about relations within a community. Yeah. And it really doesn't say much about outsiders. It doesn't say anything really about how you must treat outsiders, right? Whether you have to give outsiders rights, whether you have to respect their interests. But outsiders do show up. There's basically three groups of outsiders who are mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. And strikingly, pretty much all of them are seen as existential threats to the United States. So the vision of the Declaration of Independence really is the government has to look after insiders, and outsiders are dangerous. So who are these people? They're the Hessian mercenaries. Towards the end of the Declaration of Independence, the drafters talk about King George bringing mercenaries to kill them. So the Hessian mercenaries. Then there's Native Americans, whom the Declaration refers to as merciless savages. And there the complaint is King George is inspiring Native Americans to attack the colonists. And then very much the same thing with enslaved people. The greatest charge that the Declaration levies against King George is he is inciting domestic insurrections, meaning he is encouraging enslaved people to seek their freedom.
So the change in our Constitution and our ideas about all of this, you say comes really with the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln's era. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so the change in our sort of conception, our self-conception as a nation, comes with Lincoln's era. It doesn't enter the Constitution until later, until Reconstruction, which is after Lincoln's death. But we get a transformation, first of the idea of America, which you can see in Lincoln's speeches. So in the early years of the Civil War, up to about 1863, he talks primarily about union. And he's talking about restoring the Union and going back to the way that things were. That's his goal. And then he shifts and he starts using the word nation. And there's this idea that, as he says in the Gettysburg Address, the nation will have a new birth of freedom. And now he's saying things are going to change. We're going to be a different country moving forward. We're going to have different values. Slavery will end. We're going to have a government that's devoted to the equality of all people.
So is that political, or do you think that there was a singular event that changed Lincoln's mind, or was this on his mind all along?
Well, that's a complicated question. And people, you know, Lincoln scholars have different views. And this is one area where I think it's hard to say I'm right and other people are wrong. And I don't know if you could find a single event. And I do mm-hmm. think, obviously, Lincoln didn't like slavery. Lincoln was opposed to slavery his whole career. Lincoln was doing what he could to fight slavery within the political system before the Civil War. But I do think that there's a moment that crystallizes it. And it's maybe not a single moment, but there's a particular historical thing that crystallizes it for Lincoln, which is Black military service. Because in the preliminary version of the Emancipation Proclamation, even when it's, you know, Lincoln is saying, if the South continues the war, slavery will end, he's still talking about compensation and colonization and mm-hmm. continuing to treat Blacks as outsiders. So then the question is, you know, what will we do with the formerly enslaved people? Maybe we can establish a new nation for them. So there's this idea of separation. In the final Emancipation Proclamation, the way it's issued, it talks about Black military service instead. And that's a critical difference, because military service has always been a path to citizenship. And once you let Black people fight in the Union Army and save the Union, it's pretty clear that they're going to be citizens. And then the whole question of how can you make sure that the former Confederate states treat these formerly enslaved people fairly and equally as they're entitled to be treated comes up. And that's what requires the 14th and 15th Amendments. And it's those amendments that really transform America into the nation we have today. So if you want one thing that makes modern America, I say it's Black military service in the Civil War.
You know, defenders of Thomas Jefferson and the founders, they have argued in the past that the Declaration of Independence really puts the nation on a path to ultimate emancipation, slowly but surely creating a more perfect union, as is said in the documents, making this concept of equality fundamental to the nation's reasoning. But many insist that Reconstruction, to fulfill that, is actually the opposite of what they intended. Is that a fair reading?
Well, I think that Reconstruction is the opposite. Reconstruction is sort of the nightmare of the founding generation. So in terms of the value of equality, you know, you've got the phrase all men are created equal in the Declaration of Independence. It was not understood to mean the government should treat everyone equally in 1776. It was understood as part of Enlightenment political philosophy about the state of nature. Abolitionists really started putting the modern reading on it. And so you do get the Declaration of Independence being used in arguments for equality from a relatively early date, but becoming more prominent around 1800 and then growing in the 1830s. The original Constitution, though, does basically nothing to protect the equality of individuals. So if you want to say that the 1787 Constitution sets us on a path towards our modern understanding of equal rights, I think that's very hard to argue. You know, it's really not there.
Now, it seems to me that what you're saying is really that we need to look at the abolitionists in America as founders.
Yes, I think that's where our values come from. And part of the point that I'm making is that this is a more accurate story, right? Thomas Jefferson is really not interested in putting in the Declaration of Independence a principle that condemns slavery. The Continental Congress wouldn't have let him do that. The Continental Congress took out a criticism of the international slave trade. You know, Thomas Jefferson is criticizing King George for encouraging enslaved people to rebel. He's not trying to end slavery with the Declaration. There's just no reason to think he's interested in that. So it's abolitionists who put this reading onto the Declaration. And one reason I think we should acknowledge that is I think it's more historically accurate. But the other is, this is a much better story, Because if you say our fundamental values are stated by Thomas Jefferson and fought for in the Revolution by those 13 states, every one of which recognizes slavery, as you said about the 13-star Betsy mm-hmm. Ross flag, it's a problematic story because we have to say our founders are hypocrites or something, and you know, undeniably they're slave owners. And so we're tied to this problematic past. But if we understand that our values come from the people who fought against the injustices of founding America, it's a much more inspiring story. And it doesn't require us to say our fundamental values can coexist with slavery and we have to make these compromises.
So how did Lincoln, he gets assassinated, obviously, but how did he see the South evolving after the war?
Well, that's another very difficult and complicated question. You know, and of course, because he does get assassinated, we don't know. The evidence that we have in terms of, you know, what Lincoln actually did and how he acted compared to Congress was that Lincoln was more conciliatory. Lincoln was not taking as hard a line. He was not demanding as much as a requirement for readmission to Congress. So if Lincoln had not been assassinated, sort of ironically, we might not have had the radical Reconstruction mm-hmm. that we did. We might not have had what I see as the real Second American Revolution, which is the destruction of founding America.
You know, again, Lincoln's assassinated, Andrew Johnson takes over, and the Reconstruction that we're talking about really begins to take shape. But it wasn't really well received by the former Confederate states.
No, it wasn't. I mean, at no time was it well received. And part of this story is what I was saying before, that the 14th Amendment is rejected mm-hmm. by the former Confederate states. And then Congress annihilates those state governments. Congress makes new states. So Congress says, hold a constitutional convention. And who can vote for delegates to this convention? Formerly enslaved men can, former Confederates can't, right? So now you've got a new political community created by Congress, and it's basically a new state. And the former Confederate states write new constitutions, and they're stunningly progressive constitutions. They have public education. They have reform of divorce laws. They have free medical services. This has never been done in the South before, and it's being done because these are new states with new political communities. But of course, you still have all the former Confederates there, and they don't like this. Right? They don't like redistribution. They don't like equality. They don't want to share government services with Black people because that shows that they are equal. So there is this violent undercurrent of resistance all through Reconstruction, and it's sort of crests and falls. And as long as the federal military is there and is active, you can keep it down and the Reconstruction integrated governments can survive. But eventually popular will breaks basically. And white Americans aren't willing to endure the discomfort of this consistent conflict and basically military occupation. And so the federal military supervision ends. And then you get the period of time that people call redemption, which is another period that we really don't teach very much because it doesn't fit with the story that we like to tell. But then you've got basically white supremacist paramilitary organizations overthrowing the legitimate governments of maybe a third of the country.
So maybe we can get in a little more. So are you talking about the Klan or organized parties, that sort of thing?
Well, so the Klan is there early in the 1870s fighting yeah. against Reconstruction, and the U.S. Army basically defeats the Klan. So it's not the Klan anymore, but there are other similar organizations that come up that work basically as the paramilitary wing of the Democratic Party. And there's a very coordinated, systematic movement to take back power. And part of it is political. So, you know, people are out there and they're voting for Democrats. And then part of it is political, but shady, sort of dirty tricks and voter suppression. Mm-hmm. of the sort that, you know, goes on throughout American history. And then part of it is just murder. Part of it is flat out violence. And there are massacres.
You mentioned that for Lincoln, perhaps one of the things that made him one of the things that may have made him change his mind was the black service in the military. As you said that, I was thinking back to the Revolutionary War, and there was a call for African Americans to serve for the colonists and also among the British. They had this Dunmore. I remember the Dunmore Proclamation, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And both sides were trying to recruit black folk to come fight for them. Do you think that that may have played a role in what Lincoln was thinking? Because while some blacks fought for the colonists, most of them, if they did fight, they fought for the British.
Yes, most of them did fight for the British, you know, which I think is not surprising, mm-hmm. given that every state recognized slavery. Sometimes the colonists offered freedom to enslaved people who would fight for them, and that explains some of the black military service on the American side. Some of those black patriot soldiers, I think, were actually there as substitutes for whites, because you could substitute. This happened during the Civil War also. You know, rather than serve yourself, you could provide a substitute. And so some white American patriots provided enslaved people as their substitutes, and that's the source of some of the black soldiers on the American side. The British, by contrast, did offer freedom, and they honored that bargain. So
once the war was over, they were free.
Once the war was over, they were free. And the British actually sort of backed off that in the Treaty of Paris. Mm-hmm. You know, they agreed to a provision that said that they would withdraw without taking with them any, in the words of the treaty, Negroes or other property of the Americans. Mm-hmm. But then they didn't honor that. You know, they said, we promised these people freedom. We're not turning them over. So in terms of slavery and the revolution, a lot of enslaved people, tens of thousands of enslaved people, gained their freedom during the revolution, but not because the patriots were fighting for freedom. It's because the revolution gave them an opportunity to escape and free themselves and find their way to the British. So, you know, what was the lesson that Lincoln took from that? I'm not sure. I think that Lincoln probably was inspired in large part by the way that the Confederates treated black American soldiers. I think that really made him realize that you needed the Constitution and the laws to require equality. Because despite the fact that black Union troops were there, you know, legally as soldiers in the uniform of the United States, they were still treated as outsiders by the Confederates, and they were not given any rights.
So now, after we tend to think about the Civil War, then Reconstruction, without realizing that Jim Crow follows all of this. And while the war is over, and you've talked about this a little bit, while the war is over and slavery is gone, what is put in place certainly does not bode well for the black folk who might be in the region, in the area, in those states.
Yeah, so the way that we teach Reconstruction and its aftermath, I think, is very superficial. But what happens is Reconstruction really works for a while. You know, as long as the federal troops are there, it works. And you've got integrated governments, you've got integrated schools in some places, you've got integrated police forces. But when federal military supervision is withdrawn, that's when the Southern whites take back control in a very violent and completely illegitimate way. So now you've got the former Confederates back in control in the South. And the Constitution places some limits on what they can do, so they can't reinstate slavery. And some kinds of overt discrimination are probably not permissible, but they go back pretty much as far as they can. So they create a society that is very clearly based on a racial hierarchy. And that's the social meaning of segregation, that there are classes of citizens and it's based on color.
To get any amendment to the Constitution, you're going to need 3/4 of the states. These former states, if you said former Confederacy, they're not going to accept them. So I'm wondering then, what possibly can you do other than what happened with Reconstruction, radical Reconstruction, and literally taking these states apart?
Well, I don't think there was an alternative.
Exactly.
This is one of the lessons of American history that I think we need to understand, that we've all been born into an unjust world, you know, and it's not our fault. It's not our responsibility that the world is the way it is. It's imperfect. That's always the case. But it's our responsibility to decide what to do about it. And there are two options. One thing you can do is you can work within the system and understand your constitution and your political institutions in the best light you can and find all the resources for justice and improvement within them that you can and try to make it the best it can be. And there's a history of doing that. You know, that's sort of what Lincoln was doing before the Civil War. That's what the Reconstruction Congress was doing before the Reconstruction Acts dissolved the Southern states. But at a certain point, it might turn out that you can't get where you need to go. And the existing system just is not going to deliver what you need. And over again through American history, starting with the Revolution and then, you know, the Constitution replacing the Articles of Confederation and then Reconstruction, over and over again, when Americans get to that point, they break the existing system and they make something new. And that's actually where our biggest advances come from. It's those revolutionary moments.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. You know, in that sense, recently when I think about discussions about the July 4th and recognizing July 4th and recognizing Juneteenth, those are two different things, really, that we're talking about, that people are looking at.
Yeah, they're very different. They're very different. Because July 4th, as I was saying earlier, is really about sort of national independence.
Exactly.
It's not about individual liberty, and it's certainly not about equality. Juneteenth is about individual liberty. So Juneteenth is not about the relationship between one people and another people. It's not about the colonists and the British Empire. It's not even really about the states and the national government. It's about individuals and those who would enslave them. You know, it's about free people and enslavers. And I think that we celebrate July 4th more than we should. And we try to put a sort of individual freedom gloss on it because we know that that's a value that we care about now. But like I was saying, if you want to know what the source of these values is and when they really come into the Constitution and when they enter American life, Juneteenth is a much better day. Or, you know, maybe the Emancipation Proclamation. Maybe the Gettysburg Address. If you want some short statement of American values, it's the Gettysburg Address. It's not the Declaration of Independence. So our whole sort of celebration of founding America and our veneration of particular dates and documents and people, I think is skewed. You know, I think we're overlooking a much better, much richer story.
I can't imagine when others read the book, that you don't get much pushback from others who prefer the traditional approach to teaching about America's past.
Well, I do. I definitely get a lot of pushback. And, you know, one of the forms that it takes is, you know who else said that? Jefferson Davis or John C. Calhoun. 'Cause it's true. The readings that I'm giving here, the arguments that I'm making about how to understand the Declaration of Independence, it's not that they've never been said before, but they were said by secessionists, basically. And part of what I'm trying to say is understanding the way that arguments worked out before the Civil War is historically important, but they don't necessarily have the same implications mm-hmm. that they used to. So the fact that Jefferson Davis, for instance, said, look, the Declaration of Independence is really about independence and it supports the South in the Civil War. I think that's actually a very strong argument. Now, if you're making that argument in 1861, it looks like you're supporting secession. If you're making that argument in 2022, it might mean something very different. It might mean, I like Reconstruction, right? That's my America. The founding is not my America.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't realize that the during the war and before the war, Confederates honored July 4th.
They did. Yeah, they celebrated July 4th. They said, you know, we are the true heirs of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And this is another thing that, like, if you think about it, it seems pretty obvious. I mean, to me at this point, it seems pretty obvious that in the Civil War, the Declaration of Independence supports the people who are declaring their independence mm-hmm. rather than the people who are denying them their independence.
We need to understand that if you really reread the Declaration of Independence, there is an argument that Confederates could make that, look, we are really the people who are defending the original ideas surrounding the founding.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So if you look at the Declaration of Independence, basically, what does it say? It says, we have this particular theory about how governments are formed and what they should do and when they can be dissolved. So governments are formed by consent. People come together and they agree to sort of mutually observe rules and protect each other for everyone's benefit. And the duty of government is to protect the rights of the people who form it. And if that government isn't working, people have a right to alter or abolish their form of government and create a new one that will do a better job of protecting the things they care about. So if you think about this from the Confederate perspective, they're basically saying, here we are, after the Declaration of Independence, we're sovereign states. We come together to form the United States, right? We ratify the Constitution in order to achieve certain goals. And one of those goals is the protection of slavery. Because if you look at the original Constitution, there are a bunch of provisions in there that protect slavery, that give extra power in the federal government to states based on people that they enslave, that deny free states the sovereign right to say that people within their borders are free. So the Confederates got a pretty good deal with the 1787 Constitution. And for 80 years, almost 80 years, they were in control of the national government. And the United States national government tilted in favor of slavery. And then that changed. And the Lincoln Republicans were taking power. And the Republican Party certainly was opposed to slavery. And now you've got the Confederates sitting there saying, look, the national government kind of wants to destroy the institution that our society is based on. Obviously, this is not a good form of government for us anymore. We're not getting the deal we signed up for. We withdraw our consent. We would like to form a new government with slightly different principles. And the Confederate Constitution changes the U.S. Constitution a little bit, but not that much. It's very similar to the 1787 Constitution. Mm-hmm. So the Confederates are saying, just like the colonists, this was a system that worked, but we think it's been taken over by people who are hostile to us and who want to exert tyrannical authority over us. And now, thank you, goodbye, right? We're withdrawing our consent. We're going to make a new form of government. It's really exactly the same as the 1776 colonists.
Yeah, I was going to say there was a concern in 1786-87, there was a concern among the Confederates that they would need some protections built into whatever document they were going to sign. So they were seeing this into the future, and the hope of others was simply to be able to form a country.
Yeah, so this is another hotly debated historical topic that people have different views about. What was going on in the drafting of the Constitution? What's the significance of slavery? But I think it's pretty accurate to say the people from there were some free states represented, and there were some states that were going to relatively rapidly abolish slavery. Mm-hmm. But the free state representatives wanted a nation. Well, or they wanted a union. They wanted the Constitution to be ratified because they realized that the Articles of Confederation were too weak and the states were going to fight with each other and maybe the Confederacy would be dismembered by European powers. So if you can't get a tighter, more effective union, the American experiment is over and it's going to be a failure. And that was the Northern perspective, right? We have to get a Constitution that can be ratified. And they weren't fans of slavery, but their main goal was union. And on the Southern side, they cared a lot about slavery. And repeatedly, they said, if you don't make this concession, if you don't give us the Three-Fifths Compromise, if you don't protect the international slave trade until 1808, we will walk out. So the South cares a lot about slavery, and they're willing, at least they say, to destroy the whole project, to blow everything up if they don't get what they want. And under those circumstances, it's not surprising that you get a constitution that tilts in favor of slaveholding interests in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, there was very real concern, was there not, that the European powers were hoping that they couldn't come up with some kind of a compromise and could go back to having the influence that they had before.
Yeah, because the states individually, some of them are reasonably strong, but certainly if the European powers can come in and set the states against each other and create conflict, they can take over America again. You know, the whole thing might fall apart.
You know, I was thinking about Dr. Martin Luther King's speech, his I Have a Dream speech, in which it seems to me in the beginning he expresses some of the same kind of things that we see in the book, where he bases the America of today upon the Emancipation Proclamation and the changes that Lincoln talked about, passage of the 14th Amendment and that sort of thing. Are those the same ideas, do you think, that you're getting through in the book?
Well, so Martin Luther King is absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. As an example of this, because you've got sort of three moments in American history that tie our standard story together. There's sort of these three repetitions of the same ideas. And the first is the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. Where I say, you know, we misunderstand that because it's really about independence. The second is the Gettysburg Address, where Lincoln says, I'm fighting in the name of the Declaration of Independence. And we've just said, you know, I don't think that's very plausible because Lincoln is fighting against people who have declared independence. And then the third is the I Have a Dream speech, where Martin Luther King echoes Lincoln. He's speaking from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, literally in Lincoln's shadow. And he starts the I Have a Dream speech by counting back to the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. So he's using the same rhetorical form and he's going back to 1863. Emancipation Proclamation, but he doesn't stay there and he doesn't talk about the Civil War or Reconstruction at all. Instead, when he's saying what determines how Black Americans are entitled to be treated, he goes back to the Declaration of Independence and the original Constitution, sort of like Lincoln did. And one of the reasons that Lincoln focuses on the Declaration of Independence, I think, is he doesn't have anything else to point to. And the really interesting thing about Martin Luther King and the I Have a Dream speech is, of course he does. He could talk about the 14th Amendment. He could talk about the 15th Amendment. Mm-hmm. He actually says racial discrimination with respect to the right to vote, that's a violation of the promise of the Declaration of Independence. And it's not really because, you know, every one of those 13 states recognized slavery. So race-based denial of the right to vote is a bit down the road there. But obviously, in 1963, when Martin Luther King is speaking, race-based denial of the right to vote violates the 15th Amendment, right? So why is King not talking about Reconstruction? And you might ask, well, maybe he just didn't think about it. And the answer is, of course he did. And there's this amazing direct evidence of that, because as a high school junior in, I think, 1944, the young King enters an oratory contest and delivers a speech called The Negro and the Constitution, which is about basically the same thing as I Have a Dream. It's what determines how Black Americans are entitled to be treated. And it's all about Reconstruction. It's all about the Civil War. It talks about conquering Southern armies with the sword. So it's embracing conflict as a way to justice. And I think what happened in between 1944 and 1963 is that King realized that that was divisive. And he decided to try to give a more conciliatory message that would enlist white moderates in support of this vision of equality. And he tried to give a speech that would bring people together, that white Americans would be willing to accept, which is basically our standard story. And then part of the lesson of Martin Luther King, and part of the lesson that I think this book is trying to deliver, is that actually that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. This kind of conciliatory, inclusive approach that brings white people together ends up leaving Black people behind. And I think that King realized that too. And you can sort of see that also in the evolution of his speeches.
You know, there is nothing saying that all of this is permanent. The 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, they passed. They did what they were supposed to do. But then I take a look at what's going on today in terms of our current Supreme Court, and seems to be giving some indication of giving back to the states much more power. So do you think that we're seeing a change in terms of a return to more states' rights being prominent, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think we are, you know, except that I probably wouldn't talk about it in terms of states' rights.
Okay.
Because it's about states' rights in the same way that the Civil War was about states' rights, which is to say there are particular rights and values that people are concerned about. And I would say it's really more about racial hierarchy.
Yes.
And, you know, that's kind of what we're seeing. And I guess not just race, but also, you know, gender-based hierarchy.
Gender-based,
I think
yeah.
There's a concern about that with Dobbs. And yes, you know, nothing is permanent. What we see historically really is sort of cycles. So we get Reconstruction and we get the Reconstruction Amendments, and there's this massive change to the Constitution, and Southern societies are rebuilt and fundamentally changed. But it doesn't last because the words on paper aren't enough. And if you don't have at the time federal military support, the governments end up being overthrown. And then we enter the period of redemption, and then Jim Crow, and the promises of the Reconstruction Amendments are more or less silenced until what people call the Second Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement of the mid-20th century. And basically, I think we're seeing the second redemption now. And actually, I would date it back, you know, maybe actually to 1980, when you start getting this kind of neo-Confederate rhetoric about distrusting the national government, about outsiders taking what belongs to real Americans. Those are kind of Reagan themes, which you then see amplified and sort of darkened in Trump. Make America Great Again, interestingly, is a Reagan campaign slogan.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. This is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Yeah, so do you think when we look at these, the debate over, say, Confederate monuments, is that wrapped up in all of this thing as well?
Yeah, because, you know, the point of Confederate monuments is to push a particular version of history. Mm-hmm. So it's telling us something about the past, and it's also telling us something about the present, because it's trying to tell us that there's something worthy of honor and veneration about the Confederate side in the Civil War, that we should honor these men. And I think that's a terrible message. I mean, I think that's arguably a message that the Constitution does not permit state governments to express. But at the least, I think it's a bad message for them to be expressing.
It would seem to me that that would also be a message that's, if you are looking at history and looking at it completely, it's more difficult to defend now than it would have been 60 or 70 years ago.
Well, I think that's true. Because one of the things that happened with the end of Reconstruction was the South sort of won the war of ideas. So the historical study of Reconstruction for a pretty long time, up until maybe the 1960s, at least among white historians, was dominated by this Southern lost cause Dunning school history, which presented Reconstruction as an oppressive overreach and a mistake, and presented redemption as sort of the restoration of the natural order of things, and suggested that the Confederates fought heroically to preserve their traditional way of life, you know, which is in some ways true, but you should look more closely at what that traditional way of life is, I think, before you decide that's a good thing to be fighting for. So, yeah, the Confederacy lost on the battlefield, but they kind of won the battle of ideas, basically because that was the way that white America could move forward together. So we'll let you have the Confederate statues, and we'll basically let you restore racial hierarchy, because trying to fight for equality is too divisive.
Kermit Roosevelt is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law. The latest book is The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story. Kermit, we appreciate today's history lesson.
Thanks so much.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or you can go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.